Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, believing growth of Florida's economy depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust works with the business community to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital team members. More information is at abletrust.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
New leaders take the gavel for the Florida legislature.
Senator Bill Galvano, president of the Florida Senate for the 2018 through 2020 term.
And the results of this year's election are finally official.
Is there a motion?
So moved.
A motion by General
Romani,
second by Commissioner Putnam. Those in favor, say yay.
Yay.
Yay. Aye.
And so the motion carries.
And several Democratic majority counties voted Republican, continuing the mystique of the Blue Dog Democrat. That's ahead on Capitol Report. Welcome to Capitol Report. I'm Lynn Hatter. The Florida legislature convened in Tallahassee before the Thanksgiving holiday for an organizational session, and Gina Jordan reports new lawmakers were sworn in and new leaders installed.
With new and outgoing state leaders looking on, Chief Justice Charles Kennedy administered the oath of office to senators in groups of five.
And repeat after me. I state your name.
I, Aaron V.
Do solemnly swear or affirm.
Bradenton Senator Bill Galvano was nominated unopposed to be the 88th Florida Senate President. Galvano was elected to the chamber in 2012. He previously served in the Florida House. In seconding his nomination, Fort Myers Senator Lizbeth Benequisto referred to Galvano's Sicilian heritage.
I'll start with three quotes from the Corleones of the Godfather that immediately come to mind when we think of you. Don't ever take sides against the family. Ever. You'll make him an offer he can't refuse, and never let anyone know what you're thinking. Now, those may seem funny to share in a nomination speech, but take note, my friends. They may be quite instructive over the next 2 years.
The Senate's approval was unanimous, as announced by outgoing President Joe Negron.
Senators, it is now my great honor to present the gavel to Senator Bill Galvano, President of the Florida Senate for the 2018 through 2020 term.
Galvano asked for civility and decorum in the Senate's interactions with fellow lawmakers and constituents.
As Senate President, I have very little ability to change the national discourse or to stem the tide of modern day incivility that is so pervasive in an era of social media and 24-hour news cycle. But I can tell you, as Senate President, and while I'm Senate President, that the Florida Senate will have civility, transparency, candor, and provide opportunity, including opportunity for the people of Florida to be heard by this body.
Longwood Senator David Simmons was elected as President pro tem, and Jacksonville Senator Audrey Gibson was chosen to lead the Senate Democratic Caucus. New members of the Florida House were also sworn in, and outgoing House Speaker Richard Corcoran announced his replacement.
By your vote, ladies and gentlemen, you have elected Representative Jose Oliva, Speaker of the Florida House of Representatives.
Hialeah Representative Jose Oliva said the chamber would work to protect the environment, care for vulnerable citizens, and provide for building and maintaining public infrastructure.
And so, members, our work begins. In this chamber, the people's chosen representatives will debate the way forward. Let us remember to honor and respect this institution and one another. And let our debate always lean on the strength of our argument rather than on the volume of our voices.
Martin County Representative Mary Lynn Magar was elected Speaker pro tem. Cape Coral Representative Dane Eagle was chosen as Republican Majority Leader. And Central Miami-Dade County Representative Keone McGee was elected to lead the House Democratic Caucus. The regular session of the legislature convenes March 5th. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Gina Jordan.
Florida's incoming governor, agriculture commissioner, and attorney general are all new. The only returning member of the state cabinet is Chief Financial Officer Jimmy Patronis. Of those races, the governor and agriculture commissioner required two recounts, a process that ended barely a week ago. The first race, Florida's governor's mansion, concluded with two concessions by Democratic gubernatorial candidate and Tallahassee Mayor Andrew Gillum.
We wanted to make sure that every single vote, including those that were overvotes, undervotes, as long as it was a legally cast vote, we wanted those votes to be counted. And now that we are rounding that process out, RJ and I wanted to take a moment to congratulate Mr. DeSantis on becoming the next governor of the great state of Florida.
Governor-elect Ron DeSantis is working on his transition and filling key positions in his administration. Despite lawsuits flying over recounts, DeSantis remained largely silent and out of the fray as he worked to take over from Governor Rick Scott, who managed to defeat incumbent U.S. Senator Bill Nelson in the third of Florida's tight races. Nelson also conceded, but in his speech, he didn't call Scott by name. Instead, he focused largely on access to health care, voting rights, and environmental protection. Nelson also took aim at the politics of division.
We have to move beyond a politics that aims not just to defeat, but to destroy, where truth is treated as disposable, where falsehoods abound, and that the free press is assaulted as the enemy of the people.
Incoming Democratic Agriculture Commissioner Nikki Fried won by the tightest margin. Only 6,700 votes separated her from Republican Matt Caldwell, who finally conceded but expressed concerns about vote counting in Broward County. Tuesday, the State Canvassing Commission formally signed off on the results, bringing an end to one of the most contentious statewide elections.
At this time, I would request that a member of the commission make a motion to certify the official returns of the 2018 general election and 2018 special election for Senate Districts 23 and 25.
Secretary of State Ken Detzner led the meeting of the canvassing board. Republican State Senator Rob Bradley sat in for Governor Rick Scott, who recused himself, and outgoing Attorney General Pam Bondi and Ag Commissioner Adam Putnam listened in by phone.
Is there a motion?
So moved.
A motion by General Bondi. Second by Commissioner Putnam. Those in favor, say yay.
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 Aye.
And so the motion carries.
Now on to the next. In January, Ron DeSantis will be sworn in as Florida's new governor, and politicians will start weighing their plans for 2020. On election night, Republican voting strongholds in the Florida Panhandle provided Governor Rick Scott and gubernatorial candidate Ron DeSantis the boost that led to their wins. Ryan Daly reports a quick look at registered voter numbers in some of those counties doesn't read that way on the surface.
In Liberty, Calhoun, and Wakulla counties, many voters break from their registered party when they hit the polls. Take Liberty County. 69% of its registered voters are Democrats, but in statewide races, they supported Republicans in a ratio that's almost the exact opposite. DeSantis pulled down 77% of the vote to Gillum's 20. In Calhoun County, registered Democrats are nearly double that of Republicans, but DeSantis was the preferred gubernatorial candidate. Liberty's Supervisor of Elections Gina McDowell, who declined an interview, said, quote, "It's always been that way." But in Wakulla, it seems that tide is turning.
We've seen a shift in Wakulla County for several years now, but typically our county was registered probably about 60% Democrat, 40% Republican for years. Since the last presidential election, we've seen that gap closing much faster.
Ralph Thomas is a county commissioner and chair of Wakulla's Republican Party. The county just this year saw Republicans overtake Democrats in registration, which Thomas says is unprecedented.
As far as I know, this is the first time in the history of Wakulla County that we've ever had a Republican majority.
Wakulla's registered Republican lead isn't by much, just north of 50%. Yet in 2016's presidential election, Donald Trump Trump got 68% of the vote to Hillary Clinton's 28%. And in Florida's midterms this year, Scott outperformed Nelson by 30% and DeSantis bested Gillum by 39%. Former Florida and U.S. Congressman Alan Boyd is a lifelong Democrat who lives in the region. He points to a changing party for answers to numbers that might perplex out-of-towners.
I watched that over the 22 years I served in elected politics. I watched it just slowly change. Each cycle we'd see the Republican numbers bump up in some of those rural counties until we got to 2010, which was the coming out of the Tea Party.
The party had begun to shift away from the so-called Blue Dog Democrats, those that espoused more conservative values. As the mainstream Democratic Party began to contrast more starkly, Republicans snapped up some of those voters.
It's hard to know exactly what was doing that, except that I think the electorate began to see the Republicans more supportive of our national defense system. They were more socially conservative on some issues such as abortion and gun rights and some of those things.
In Boyd's estimation, it's been mostly white men who have been leaving the Democratic Party, but he says Democrats have been winning over the Hispanic vote, which he says is coveted by politicos in the state. Though he maintains when both parties are thriving, everyone benefits.
We really need two strong parties in a two-party system. Our government works best when there's a divided government. And there's an old saying that I think that's been proven several times. I saw it happen a couple of times during my service, 22 years of service, is power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely.
For Florida Public Radio, I'm Ryan Daly.
Still to come on Capitol Report, should there be an upper limit on the age for a Florida driver's license? And what, if anything, should be done to help those older drivers who lose their driving privilege?
I think a bad thing to do would be to just take someone's license away and then not give them any other option.
We take a trip to the Forgotten Coast a month after it was struck by Hurricane Michael.
We said at day three after the hurricane, if it is physically possible to do this, we're going to do it.
And Florida's storied orange industry has its roots in World War II. There's plenty to catch a Floridian's attention these days. A major storm, an election, and then a recount, and what's to come next year. But as Regan McCarthy reports, those hit hardest by Hurricane Michael are hopeful that as the rest of the state moves on, the Forgotten Coast will be remembered.
I don't want us to be forgotten, because so many times we are forgotten up here. So any help you can give us, I would be grateful to.
That's former Speaker of the Florida House, Alan Bentz. He's part of a group of state leaders heading up Rebuild 850, an initiative aimed at helping those in the panhandle recover following the storm. One of the goals of the group is encouraging people to invest, give, volunteer, and visit the areas impacted by Michael, where locals are working to ensure people know they're open for business. One example, the Apalachicola Seafood Festival.
We said at day three after the hurricane, if it is physically possible to do this, we're going to do it.
John Solomon is the president of the Apalachicola Seafood Fest Board. A Ferris wheel, food trucks, and music venues are set up across a still slightly muddy field that Solomon says was covered in more than 6 feet of water following the hurricane. But he says the tradition of the festival is important.
For years, that was the purpose of the Florida Seafood Festival, was to draw people to this area, to the Forgotten Coast, and drive the economy in a time that in November, you got 3 or 4 months before we start seeing really big tourism again. And it kept the businesses open. It kept them fluid. And nothing, it couldn't be more true than it is this year of the reason we had to have it, is to bring people back to Franklin County. Let them know that we're open for business. We took one on the chin, we stood up, dusted ourselves off, and we're back in business.
And Solomon says it's not just about keeping those businesses open. It's about helping community members stay afloat too.
Definitely homes, definitely, you know, people are needing help with, you know, they didn't have insurance and they need help because they didn't have a job for weeks. And that's kind of another reason we had the Florida Seafood Festival, because of a tourist-driven economy. businesses don't need employees if we don't have tourists. Well, if we had the festival, it brings the tourists, and also the people that came, their Facebook friends, their other friends, now know that Franklin County is open for business, and that brings tourists back to Franklin County, which helps those people get a job and continue their career.
And then there's the community spirit that Demetrius Cummings says could use a boost about now.
No, I think it's great that all these people came down after all them storms, that bad storm we had, and it really, you know, makes it feel like a seafood festival again, being that we just went through all that turmoil with that storm.
Cummings is wearing a red velvet cape and crown. He carries an oyster rake as a scepter as he waves to fairgoers. He is the oyster king of this year's seafood festival and says it's important because it gives people who've gone through something difficult a chance to focus on something more positive. Officials say the festival saw visitors from as far away as Panama City and Mexico Beach. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
Should there be a mandatory retirement age when it comes to driving? Some new research suggests that older drivers are statistically among the safest drivers. But Tom Flanagan tells us that does not mean that every senior should have a guaranteed license for life.
Just type in the words older drivers in YouTube's search engine and you'll find lots of videos like this one in which a young motorcyclist flags over a seemingly befuddled older driver whose car is smoking because of a motor oil leak.
Are you okay? Are you okay? Okay, well, I think you just lost all your oil, so you better turn your car off. Yeah, no, now your engine's smoking. Turn your car off. Turn your car off. Your oil!
A moment later, the older gentleman drives away, seemingly oblivious to the fact his car is on the verge of self-destruction. There are lots of other videos showing an endless selection of older drivers driving badly. But Florida State University psychology professor Walter Boot says these are actually the exceptions, not the rule.
There are many stereotypes about older drivers that they're particularly crash prone, but younger drivers are also crash prone as well. If we look at the demographics in terms of who gets into crashes, the most inexperienced drivers also have an elevated crash risk.
In fact, says Booth, the data suggests that the average older driver is, by and large, a pretty safe driver.
They obey speed limits more. Many older adults recognize they're not as quick in reacting as they used to be, so they actually drive sensibly in terms of speed limits so that they have more room to brake that if something suddenly happens.
And ironically, younger drivers may overly depend on their faster reaction times to get them out of trouble, so they tend to be more casual about their driving.
Younger drivers, if we can get them to stop texting while driving or stop kind of interacting with their phone while they're driving, that would be a great thing.
However, Boot stresses there are issues for many senior motorists.
There are older drivers who are experiencing perceptual and cognitive declines that perhaps should not be on the road, but there are many older drivers who are just fine.
The big challenge, says Boot, is telling the two groups apart.
It's a very complicated question, and there's no one test out there right now that really captures a fitness to drive, in my view.
This is a big public policy issue. How does the state ascertain who gets to keep driving and who does not after a certain age, and what should that age be?
But what we need to do is figure out ways to determine safe drivers from unsafe drivers. And for unsafe drivers, how do we support them? I think a bad thing to do would be to just take someone's license away and then not give them any other option.
Because, notes Professor Boot, even in most of Florida's biggest cities, public transportation can leave much to be desired. And for those in outlying areas,
it's a particular problem for older adults who are in these rural communities where public transportation isn't readily available. So we need to think about novel solutions. And I think there are rideshare programs for older adults that people are talking about and that exist already.
But still, lack of mobility can mean isolation, depression, medical problems, and even an increased mortality rate for older folks. Still, Boot is quick to point out that it's not only drivers that can be unsafe. He says many of Florida's streets and highways, by their very design, contribute to traffic crashes. So he's sharing the research data with the Department of Transportation. Out of this, he says, can come improved signage, signals, and when needed, even complete realignment of roadways to make them safer.
And what's nice about that is that it helped the older drivers in our research, so we did driving simulator studies, but also helped the younger drivers as well. When we think about good design for older adults, it's usually good design for younger adults as well. So most of the changes that we look at in terms of supporting older adults in the roadway in our driving simulator studies and our other studies seem to help younger drivers too, so everyone benefits.
But regardless of age, won't everyone eventually be equally safe on the roads when automated cars take over and people won't have to drive at all?
It's going to be a very, very long time before we have completely autonomous vehicles that won't require human intervention at some point. And as long as the human is in the loop, and I think that's going to be the case for a very long time, we need to think about age-related changes and how they impact our ability to interact efficiently and safely with technology, which would be kind of what we're talking about in terms of autonomous vehicles.
So at least for now, Professor Boot's best advice is obey the traffic laws, don't text and drive, look out for the other guy, and buckle up. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Tom Flanagan.
It's citrus harvesting season in Florida, where oranges make up the largest part of an $8 billion industry. It's a business that owes much of its success to the military and the frantic effort to feed the troops who fought overseas in World War II. WUSF's Bobby O'Brien reports on how that wartime effort led orange juice to become an American breakfast staple.
It fell to the U.S. Army quartermaster to feed the more than 8 million soldiers who would fight in World War II. And that task involved more than canned meat and biscuits provided in World War I, as detailed in this 1942 training film.
Since the last war, nutrition has become a science. And our Army Quartermaster Corps uses that science in planning Army meals.
And plenty of vitamin C was essential for troop nutrition to prevent scurvy in both land and naval forces. Historian Matthew Eng wrote an article for the U.S. Naval Historical Foundation that looked at nutrition in World War II.
But lack of vitamin C is a real thing, especially when you're in warfare. You might not be getting vitamin C in your regular old ration, basically going to be getting calories.
The military needed a way to get vitamin C to overseas troops. Fresh fruit wasn't an option because of shipping and spoilage, so they launched a huge effort to increase the production of a beverage that wasn't very popular at the time, canned orange juice. Ben Hill Griffith III's family had several citrus groves in the town of Frostproof, Florida. When the war broke out, the government came calling. The military needed so much juice that the Griffin family and other growers expanded, planting an additional 100,000 acres in the 1940s.
We had fresh citrus that we would deliver to the government to be dispersed with the troops, and we also had canned orange juice and canned grapefruit juice. Dare say that the quality at that time was not as good as what we put up today, but that was a matter of not having the refrigeration.
Then came the challenge of processing all that fruit. The federal government stepped up again. It had some of the 10,000 POWs in Florida build a huge plant with the Citrus Growers Cooperative. The 65-acre plant in Lake Wales still produces orange juice today. Chip Henry is CFO at Citrus World Incorporated, the parent company of the cooperative, now known as Florida's Natural.
The construction of this site began during the war years. A lot of the infrastructure that's here, what you don't see, the underground, the piping and all, was actually constructed by German prisoners of war. Now imagine these fellows were glad just to have something to do.
During the war, Florida surpassed California in orange production. But the state's real windfall came just as the war ended. The Florida Citrus Commission and the U.S. Department of Agriculture quietly worked together during the war to develop a better way to preserve orange juice. Their discovery was frozen concentrate orange juice. It didn't come in time to be shipped to the troops, but Florida's Natural CEO Bob Baer says it became a big hit when those veterans came home and started families.
We were largely a grapefruit industry prior to the 1940s, and it was the emergence of orange juice during the war effort and then following that with frozen concentrate that really put orange juice on the map here in this country. Before long, it was on everybody's breakfast table.
I'm Flora the Florida orange, and I'm loaded with vitamin C.
I'm Bobby O'Brien in Tampa.
That's why everybody needs a lot of little. Oh, me.
Finally tonight, sea level rise can feel like a faraway problem. Some artists in Miami have been working on an augmented reality project depicting how climate change and sea level rise could impact Miami, depending on the decisions people make today. The app brings murals to life and shows viewers alternate futures. It's created by the nonprofit Before It's Too Late. Linda Chung is the head of the project. She recently spoke with WLRN's Alicia Zuckerman at the Sea Level Rise Town Hall.
You know, for a topic like climate change, which can sometimes be very hard, or you kind of just want to avoid it, or it's very factual, it's like, how do you kind of add that new, like, lens to it? That empathy, but also not make it so negative, you know? Make it beautiful, make it kind of hopeful and about the future vision. And so, you know, I really wanted to get into the art, using art and technology, merging the two. And at first I was working on virtual reality, and then I kind of realized when I was working with virtual reality, most people didn't have access to virtual reality, so that was a huge limiting factor.
And so what's the difference between, and so you ended up with augmented reality, what's the difference between virtual reality and augmented reality?
So it's really the same sort of platform. The main difference is virtual requires a headset, so you actually, it's supposed to take over your reality virtually, versus augmented reality augments your current reality, which you can easily access augmented reality through the smartphone, for instance. So pretty much everyone has a smartphone. So I really think AR is going to take off much faster than VR. And then in terms of the murals, you know, coming into Miami, I dabbled a lot in many different projects. But, you know, you come to Miami, I'm like, there's two places that people come. They come to see the beach. They come to see Wynwood. There's a whole mural culture. And it's like, why is this Wynwood Walls thing so popular? Like, I want to create my own project. It's called Miami Murals. But these murals have augmented reality. And there's a real message here, which is around climate change, which is, to me, the most important and urgent issue here in this region. That all the artists, really, if we could gather that talent and work together to use our art, you know. So that's sort of the vision for Miami Murals.
And so that's Miami Murals, and then there's another project, which is the framed artwork that you saw outside, which is a collaboration with the Miami artist Rainier Gamboa. And that's a project, when you told me the name of that project, it sort of like gave me chills in not a great way, I have to say.
Yeah.
It's called, tell us what it's called.
It's called Remembering Miami. So, you know, we were very, this idea of remembering, memory is very emotional. It also kind of has a sense of time, which is really what it is. Climate change is all about time, and it's a very abstract issue that moves slow, and so that's why it's so easy for us to kind of ignore it. But this whole idea is if you could just think about everything from the perspective of time, like we're really doing this whole storytelling series from the lens of the future, as if we're archaeologists from the future looking back on today. And if we don't act correctly, all of this could be underwater by, you know, 2100. And how would you talk about today from the lens of time?
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Ryan Daly, Gina Jordan, and Regan McCarthy. We also thank our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Lynn Hatter. Tom Flanagan will be back next week. Join us each Friday for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows, at wfsu.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, dedicated to connecting businesses and workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to recruit, interview, and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. AbleTrust.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.